This episode of the Everything Matters podcast is brought to you by BeLegendary.coach, where we transform leaders into legends. Are you a senior leader, entrepreneur, or executive looking to take your leadership to the next level? Are you dealing with things such as imposter syndrome, concerns with whether or not your leadership is lingering long after you've completed FaceTime? Looking for new and innovative ways to connect with your team and to gain buy-in from stakeholders that you deal with on a daily basis? If any of this sounds like something that you're dealing with and you would like to take your leadership to an extraordinary level, your effectiveness to a legendary level, visit BeLegendary.coach. That's www.BeLegendary.coach and schedule your free performance analysis today. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the next episode of the Everything Matters podcast. Today's guest is someone that's truly special to my heart. I'm big on mentors and having people that are in your life that inspire you, that move you into action about what you want to create for yourself in your life. Really love that kind of stuff. This individual goes back years ago when I was a college athlete at Northwestern State University. We had coaches, we had head coaches, assistant coaches, and we'd also sometimes have graduate assistants who were graduate students also assisting as coaches on the football team. Coach Fitzhill was one of those grad assistants when I was in school there, and I always looked up to him. He always had something wise and something positive to share, also knew how to have fun, kept it light, but also made sure you worked your butt off and you knew what it meant to be a young man in the world, particularly a young Black man. Coach Fitz is a former head football coach, a decorated veteran of Desert Storm, college president, and a radio personality where he talks about leadership and spirituality. What he's most proud of, however, and takes a ton of pride in, is being a dad and what he calls a grand coach to his grandkids. So be ready to experience the wealth of knowledge, wisdom, and years of experience that Coach Fitz is going to bring to the conversation. And I'm so happy to share this moment with him. He's an Arkansas native, and I'm so thrilled to be able to connect with him to have a man-to-man conversation about something that's so passionate for him, which is, in my opinion, one of the most important epidemics that we currently face in America, and it's the Black male homicide epidemic. So I encourage you to please stay tuned for the whole time. He offers a ton of value, statistics and everything, and also a possible solution, a playbook that he's been working on that will hopefully get us out of this epidemic that we currently find ourselves in. So please join me in welcoming my friend, my mentor, my coach, Coach Fitzhill, to the Everything Matters podcast. Coach, let's get it popping, man.
Coach Fitz, man, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You know, we've been trying to get this together for several months now. We kind of crossed each other on social media, and some of the things you post are really inspired by, and some of the things I post, you know, you'll like because you inspire. So I think that we're kind of thinking in the same direction along a lot of lines. So I wanted to get you to come onto the podcast, man, and really share your perspective and your point of view and what you see that can make a difference. So thank you for being here to the podcast and joining me today, man.
Well, no, I'm honored to do so and proud of you, Brad. And I connected back in 1988 at Northwestern State University.
Don't tell him my age, Coach.
You're aging good. You like fine wine, you know.
Hey, so you already know.
He's standing now. I just sent Treadway a congratulatory for going into the Hall of Fame. So he just hit me back actually this morning. So I think that's pretty interesting that I'm here with you, your teammate today.
I know, man.
To kick off this discussion.
Yeah, man. I love it. You know, and I want to really get into the value that coaches play in young men's lives, man. Cause, you know, Tap kind of in and out here. So me, Tread, Taterhead, Tap, and J-Rob, we have a monthly Zoom that we do, and we all get together and just kind of reconnect and talk about our families and what's going on. We watch the Super Bowl, you know, we watch games together online. And one of the things that comes up a lot is you. Like, you made such an impact on us as young men, man, at Northwestern State. And we always talk about you, man. Coach Hill, man, you know, he's so detailed, man. Like, you're going to be like, right, you know. So you have these coaches that make such a huge impact, man. So I want to give you your flowers right now while you're on my podcast. I want to thank you for not just being a contribution to me, but all the hundreds and thousands of young men that you had an impact on, that you've made such a difference with in your time in higher education, your time in coaching, and what you're doing right now, man. So I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, man. I love you. And thank you for everything you did for me and supporting me and being away from my mom.
Well, that's what coaching is about. You know, the fatherhood and to replace oftentimes many of our young men didn't have fathers. And so, you know, God calls us to be a blessing to others. You know, as a person wrapped up in himself makes for a real small package. We're called to bless other people. And that's how, you know, the legacy that we serve, I mean, that the legacy that we create today is what people see tomorrow. And that's why we celebrate Black History Month, particularly this month. And we're looking at all the people who came before us. And I'm grateful for those, because for that reason, I have had the opportunities to be blessed to do the things that God has blessed me to do, from leadership positions that never would have happened 50 or 60 years ago.
Absolutely, man. And you continue to clear the path for those behind you. So I thank you again for that, man.
Yeah. So, hey, I want to talk about, I know you're an Arkansas boy, you know, and you let your son Juice go play at LSU in my home state. So I thank you for letting his talent go down there and help out the Tigers. You
know,
I know you grew up in Arkansas. So tell me about, you know, what life was like for you as a child growing up in Arkansas. First of all, tell us what part of Arkansas you grew up in. I think it was Little Rock, but I'm not sure. And then tell us what it was like for you, man. What were some of the things that were instilled in you as a child, some of the values that I know your parents are a big part of your life and a big influence, inspiration for you. So talk to us about your childhood, man. What was it like growing up there?
Yes, I grew up in Southwest Arkansas and Arkadelphia, Arkansas. And I actually just spoke last week back at a Black History celebration at my alma mater, Wichita Baptist University. And Arkadelphia was a very supportive environment. In fact, as I shared, Brad, many things that I would experience at Arkadelphia, it really shocked me once I got outside the doors of Arkadelphia, because you know, I had a lot of support in a southern, you know, Southwest Arkansas city, and I never had any barriers or restrictions. And even though, you know, I born in 1964, in the 60s and 70s, and I left there going to Northeast Louisiana in 1982 to play college football, and why I ended up at Northwestern with Coach Joseph in 1988. Right. But I never had a whole lot of restrictions, and the supportive environment just growing up from playing baseball, football, basketball, running track, you know, coaches had a huge influence on my life. But I think, you know, that changed once I got outside of football, but Arkadelphia, got outside of Arkadelphia, but the city itself gave me so much support. And I remember, you know, in seventh grade, where I think our class, our student body was 28-30% African American, but you know, I was student council president in seventh grade. I was student council president in ninth grade. I was class president in eighth grade. I was class president in 11th grade. I was student council president in 12th grade, you know, president of FCA. So, I mean, you know, I didn't have a lot of barriers that said, you know, that I couldn't do anything. And and so when I left, though, and I, you know, entered to a new environment, that was not the same, and kind of threw me for a loop.
Yeah, I bet it did, man. And that's interesting, because you don't typically hear that in a place like Arkansas, that you didn't have those barriers as a young Black man, right? So, you know, let's talk about that. Like, so, you know, we know that our childhood and what we experience as kids plays a huge role in the context that it creates for the life that we live in, that we have. How much would you say that experience in Arkadelphia growing up and having that supportive community wrapped around you, how big of a difference did that make for you in going out and not seeing any barriers in your life at all? Like, you just knew, hey, I can do anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It first started at home. You know, I had a mother that was highly influential in the community. And I had a father who was a hard worker that I worked with on Saturdays, that I helped clean up offices and stuff. So, you know, I had a role model that as a father, and I had a mother who was tied relationally within the community. I mean, she was, you know, she was the first African-American registrar at Arkadelphia High School. So when the schools integrated, she was the first person. So she was relationally connected, which she made sure her children were relationally connected because of that. So as I saw her maneuver through what we call the biculturation process of working on both sides you know, an African American community, never looking down on our community, and, you know, and not allowing other people to degrade Black people in that community is something I learned from her just by observing, and it taught me a lot. So, you know, she even taught me tact. So when I experienced things were of people degrading or racial derogatory comments, how to address those and to do it very respectfully without turning it into a argument. You know, so she really taught me that. And that's something I use to this day, because when two people scream and nobody hears each other.
Nobody hears each other. And nothing gets done. There's nothing constructive that comes out of it. Totally agree. Totally agree. Well, hey, I know growing up there, and it sounds like you played all sports like I did, baseball, basketball, football, track, and the whole nine. When were you first introduced to sports? And what age were you in? What was the first sport you were introduced to?
No, I'm the youngest of three boys. And so it was like drinking water, outside. So I started doing ball 4 or 5 years old outside with my brother. They were older. So I remember always playing with my brother. I had a brother who was my oldest brother was 10 years older. My second brother was 5 years older. So I was always trying to be around them. That's really, laid the foundation of me being the athlete, you know, that was, because that's what we did all summer, all day. We played ball. We had a big lot beside our house. We played football, basketball, baseball. Yep. We broke so many window panes at our house that my mother, she wouldn't change them anymore. I mean, if she said,
just put a screen up, keep going.
I put a board up there and said, I'm not doing it anymore. She said, hey, I'm not going to stop y'all from playing, because here's what I learned. She always loved for us playing in the backyard, because she could watch us. And so that was huge. Yeah. Just say, hey, come on to our house and play.
That's right.
And so she never ran people off. And so, you know, I kind of did that when I moved back to Little Rock. You know, I put a pool, a court, and everything. And because I thought about my muscle, our house was where you wanted the kids to be. And then as long as you had that, the kids wanted to be at home. And so as a parent, you felt good being able to look out there, and everybody wanted to come to your house. And you fed everybody, and it was good. Well, that's what my parents did for me.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, it sounds like I grew up at your house, because that's exactly what it was like for me. And I want to get more into that a little bit later on, because I think that's something that really connects us around the social issues that we both see in our country and in the world. So I want to come back to that. So I want to, Coach, man, you've done a lot of stuff. I mean, you left Northwestern. You were a grad assistant when you left Northwestern. You came to Northwestern. You were a grad assistant, working as a receivers coach. And again, made a huge difference for us, man. We loved having you there. And then you left Northwestern. You went on to get your, I think you were actually studying for your master's when you were there, if I'm not mistaken. You were studying for your master's degree.
At Northwestern, correctly.
Yep, at Northwestern. And you left there, went and got your doctorate at some point in your career. You have been a head coach, a college football team. You were a veteran of Desert Storm, which I remember those days. I had cousins and friends of mine that went to high school, also served in Desert Storm. So I want to stop and thank you for your service around that. You've been a college president and a radio personality. And you're also a grand coach, which we'll get to in a moment. But man, what drove you to go? I mean, you've had a long, full life, man, and you're still young. Like, what drove you to go through, you know, to get your master's, to get your doctorate, you know? And I'd imagine it comes from your parents, but why don't you create for us and let us, you know, just let us into what that world is like. What was like? What drove you?
Well, I always said, you know, I realize, I've told my children many times, oftentimes when people look at us as Black people, and I learned this from coaching, is that in most situations, African Americans are evaluated collectively, where our peers are evaluated individually. So when they start looking at us, people look at us collectively until you distinguish yourself. So what I decided to do, I said, education is a way to distinguish yourself. And taking jobs that nobody else wants to take. That's how I got a Bronze Star. Hey, sir, I'll take that mission. You know, I'll move. I'll go north. I'll support the 18th and 7th Corps for doing that. Even though it's not something, you know, I wanted to do, but I knew it was something that was going to grow me in a way that I was not comfortable. We don't grow in comfort. We grow in discomfort. So taking on challenges that's not the norm is what I embrace. For example, I don't play golf because, as you mentioned, during the summers, I was in school trying to get my doctorate. All right. So yeah. when people say, hey, let's, right. we're going on vacation. No, I'm going to be over here studying in school. And so to this right. day, I may putt, but I can't play right. golf or lick. Don't, you don't want me on your team. You know, if you're, I'm not the guy, you know, to be able to do that. But I've always yes, tried to find a way to say, how will I, you know, distinguish myself from the yeah. pack? All right. Yep. And so it's education. It's taking, you know, responsibilities that other people don't want. You know, take, you know, I tell my son, doing things you don't want to do allows you to do things that you want to do. Man. But it's the discipline, it's the sacrifice that you have to do in order to put yourself there and not trying to take the easiest position, you know, or the path that's, you know, that everybody travels. It's the least, yes. less travel path that gives you the most opportunities to do the things that you want to do.
Man, so well said, Coach. So well said. You know, and as you share that, it put me in the mind of prime time, Deion Sanders, right? Yeah. He took a job at Jackson State that probably most people wouldn't take.
Yep, exactly right. Yep.
Right? And yep. look what came out of that 3 years later. Look what came out of, and also now look at other guys who are also entertaining coaching jobs in HBCUs. Oh, yeah. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, he opened up a whole new lane just by doing something that was uncomfortable that maybe no one else wanted. And he did it.
Right.
And he created a whole new path, man. So that what you said really resonates with me. It makes a ton of sense. A ton of sense. Yep.
It's really biblical. When you look back okay. at it, you know, and looking at how things pretty much happen and how God will use certain situations and you know, uh-huh. and bless it beyond any man can produce within himself. You know, Prime yeah. is a perfect example of his faith that said, hey, God told me to do this and do that. And so, but in order to hear God, you can't listen to other people.
You better believe that. If you want right. to hear anything, you can listen to other people.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, you have to be tuned. I call it to have the 5G of the Wi-Fi code. That's God, because he's been dealing with us Wi-Fi since Moses. I mean, you know, so now after he gave the Ten Commandments, it's been what? But what's your signal? Can you hear him now? You know, how does that work? Because sometimes you're not patched into that line. You know what I'm saying? And so you got true. To have the code. You know, here I am. I had to get the Wi-Fi code to be on here. If my Wi-Fi code wouldn't work, we wouldn't be talking today. Right now.
No connection, right?
And so, it's the prayer of the righteous man prevaileth much. And like I said, God don't bless mess. He bless righteousness.
Mm. Coach, you dropping gym. You and Prime might be brothers. Y'all dropping gems, man. I love it. So I sort of... alluded to it earlier, and I just while we're talking about sports and everything that you've done, and I know you've moved on to a sort of a different phase in your life right now, still working, still running campaigns for fundraising, you know, president of an organization there in Little Rock to do that. I mean, you're still busy, still working, still making moves, still making a difference. You know, but one of the things that in watching your social media, I know that's a big deal for you is family, right? Yeah. And obviously that comes from, you know, what you saw growing up from your mom and dad. And there's one little guy. I think his name's Deuce.
Is it Dice? Dice Cube.
I see Dice Man running around. I see you in the backyard with him throwing football. You got to do a drill. You're getting it right. Right.
Yep.
So talk about family, man. And you also raised your son, Juice, and your beautiful daughter, man. And Juice is playing basketball at LSU. And, you know, you have a huge commitment to family, man. And your lovely wife, I mean, what does family mean to you? And what does it mean for you to have grandchildren you can spend that kind of time with, man, and really pour into and be a contribution to them at this stage of your life?
Well, I mean, if when you look at it, you know, I said it's God, family, and then my purpose in life. That's my trinity, as I call it. My God, you know, my family and my purpose, and my kids are you know, give me purpose. My son is my namesake. And so my mother always taught me a good name is better than great richness. And you know, that's biblical. And building trust because of who you are, and what you do, not what you say. What we speak, what we do speak so loud, people can't hear what we say. So let your work, you know, speak for itself. And pouring out into my children is outside of my relationship with God is the most important thing to me because I realize the impact of a father because biblically a father is really like blessing his own little kingdom. And the reason that we see that the problems we see in our community today is because the blessing, as the Bible talks, comes through the man. And when that's removed, then our families are not protected. Point case is in the wilderness and, you know, in the jungles of Africa. When Simba is there with the lioness, the cubs are good. But without that protection, if the lioness is doing all the hunting and nobody's there to take care of the cubs, the hyenas then come in and take. Well, that's what happens oftentimes in our community. That family structure is fractured. And so we don't have the protection of our young men and our young ladies. And for that reason, today, homicide is the number one cause of death for black males age 1 to 12. Now, think about that. Homicide. In the United States of America is the number one cause of death for not only black boys from 1 to 12, but black men, black males from 1 to 44. Homicide is responsible for the most deaths in America from that age group of any type of death that we have. And that is tied back into the breakdown of the nuclear family.
Man, you just unpacked a whole bit. I was just went to lunch with a buddy of mine today, and we got into this conversation. And I told him you and I were going to be getting on a podcast today, and I said this might come up. So I said, you know, Coach Fitz, that's his walking stick right there. He sees. So, man, you know, let's just talk about it. I agree with you 1,000% that the male has been under attack for a while. You know,
yes.
Toxic masculinity and all these names that have been thrown around on social media and put into, you know, into other forms of media to really bring the male down in a sense to devalue the man. And you see that women are rising, which is great. There's nothing wrong with women being great. But something is missing when that man is not in that hole and that man is not protecting in the way that he's designed to protect. What I believe, what you believe. Something is missing and something goes awry. And we can see that happening right now. Now, when you look at, you know, one of the unique positions that you had in coaching at a college level, that you bring young men in at 17, 18 years old, and you get a chance to see where they're coming from, what their world was like, you know, and a lot of these guys that go to college and play football, man, they come from some real rough situations, man.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so if you don't have a father at home, you never get a chance to see an example of what it looks like to be a man. Right. The responsibilities of being a man, the responsibility of being a father. Like, what does that look like? Right. So when that guy is taken out, what does he look to? Something on TV? He has the rappers, the athletes, that those become his role models. Right.
Yep.
And it's something that other races of people are winning in and we're absolutely losing and finishing last in. You know, so the stats that you gave are staggering. I mean, you know, these aren't even natural causes. Like, you think that people will be dying from natural causes, but it's homicide. Like, we're killing homicide. Each other. Right?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And then you think about that, the number one cause, when you become 45, the number one cause of death is heart disease. When you become 64, it's cancer. So those are things. Here's my deal is that, look, I can't do anything about your conditioning, your lifestyle. If you want to go to McDonald's and eat, that's why I just don't want you to get killed going to McDonald's. You see what I'm saying?
Right. Exactly.
It's your statement, you know, to be able to do that. But think about this, Brett. Growing up, I'm older. I was born in 1964. So the 60s and 70s, you rarely heard the term mentoring. Now, think about this. No. Mentoring has become a default word because you don't have a support system from home.
That's right.
Foster care. When things are biblically as God has decided, those things are not needed, but they have become the default because we have been fumbling the Ten Commandments. We have been fumbling the scripture. The best game plan, I have three plays that I try to run every day biblically, which drives my every decision. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and all else will be added. And all thy ways acknowledge me and I will direct thy path. All good things work for those who love the Lord and live according to his purpose. Now, if I run those three, what I realize, I may not get to the end zone, but I know God going to end up showing up because I'm executing his plays.
Right.
But we as a community, if you look at the fact in 1960, 80% of our families were built as God intended, even though we're struggling. And, you know, and I speak quite frequently, Brad, and here's what's interesting. I'm oftentimes said, well, Coach Hill or Dr. Hill when I'm speaking and said, I think you do not consider the value of racism for that the impact of a homicide. He said, because, you know, black people kill black people, white people kill white people, Asian kill Asians, Hispanic kills Hispanic, Jews kill Jews. Right. I said, you're exactly right. Homicide in most cases, it is relational.
Yeah.
I say, but here's where we cannot be an ostrich and put our head in the sand. We're the only ethnicity, okay, where it is an epidemic and the only ethnicity where it's the number one cause of death. So we're not comparing apples to apples. We can't be asleep over here to say, well, we're not as bad as this when we are losing black men, black fathers, and not only that, I call it the homicide grenade. On average, research will show 2.5 black males are charged for each homicide or attempted homicide. So every time that goes off, we're losing 3 men. That's fathers, uncles, big brothers in the community. So we don't have that mentoring base that we used to have because they're being extrapolated to the grave and to the into the penitentiary. And so that's something that we can no longer sit around here and think we can't compare ourselves, you know, and to other people when we're 6.7% of the population in the United States of America, but we're responsible for 56% of the homicide. Now think about that. So you and I in that 7%, but we're not shooting each other. So what you do, then you have to extrapolate the data a little bit further. All right. Well, most of those homicide comes between the age of 15 and 34. Well, that's really only 2% of the population. So now you pull that out on. Yeah. So now you're saying 2% of the population is responsible for 56% of the homicide. Brad, that's some staggering numbers that we cannot as a community be crickets. Now we can stop COVID-19. Brad, I'm in Desert Storm. Well, one thing I'm most proud of, I have a Bronze Star for serving in Desert Storm. But I'm over there in Desert Storm with M16 and my ammunition, my weapons, and I don't know anybody in Kuwait. Wow. I don't know anybody in Iraq. I don't know anybody out there in the Middle East.
Right.
And I'm fighting for somebody else. And I'm over here and I got, right here in America, I got people dying that I know, mothers calling, so-and-so lost their child, and we're not doing anything for our local, but boy, we just sent $40 billion to Ukraine. And I mean, I hate on that, but I'm saying, listen, you know, we got a problem here. We, you know, Chicago and certain places may be as dangerous, you know, as Ukraine right now.
Yeah,
when you start looking at the numbers.
That's right.
And the death. So, you know, we're talking about almost 10,000 African-Americans murdered each year. Each year.
Wow.
In the United States of America. And since 1950, over 450,000 African-American males have been murdered in our country. More than was murdered in World War I, II, Korean, Vietnam, and Desert Storm. And
all
we're
combined.
Crickets.
All combined. All combined.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting when, you know, I always say follow the money, right? And the reason that we were in Kuwait, the reason that we were in Afghanistan, those places like that, is because there's money there. There's resources that somebody wants to get access to.
Yep.
And they're willing to kill, steal, and destroy to get it. But no one's willing to kill, steal, and destroy to save the lives of the people right here at home is what you're saying. I mean,
that's
we're
right.
not willing to stand up and put the same types of resources and energy behind saving the lives, same energy.
But you said something that we have to hit. You said follow the money, right? Well, you keep following the money. You look at the $300 billion prison system, the $300 billion annually. All right.
That's right.
Who goes to who's in those prisons? 60% of prisoners are men of color. I believe by following the money, what you will find, if we as a community, and Denzel Washington said this, is my favorite brothers and mentors that I love what he stands for. Denzel said, you know, we know the criminal justice system is not fair to boys of color. He says, so as a community, our responsibility is keep black boys out of the criminal justice system. Because once you go face in the 13th Amendment, you know, from prison. When you go back and look, yeah, we outlaw prison. But if you commit a crime, then what you have said, you've opened yourself up to go to prison. And then you really are a hired prisoner, yeah, you know, for our country.
That's right.
Well, a slave in many instances. So you have a $300 billion business. All right. That's tied into the economy of the United States of America, that if black boys quit going, we probably would see a recession.
Yeah, you're right. And the other thing about this, a lot of people may not know that these prisons are all privately owned as well. You know,
some of us coming back to the state, but you know, there have been, yeah. You saw on LinkedIn when I wrote the article, here's a judge that's taking money. I think one of them called Negro by the Pound. That was one of the things that they were doing is trying to put people, I mean, when you come in that, because he had an interest in it and he had to feel the best. Listen, if you build a prison, okay, if you build it, you have to fill it. You cannot go to prison virtually. They can't.
That's right.
We can't sit up here and yeah, you're going because you got 2.5 million beds. And if building prisons was going to stop, you know, the crime, it should have stopped a long time ago. We've been building. What has that got?
That's right. It doesn't work, man. We have a system that doesn't work. And the thing about it is, in order to fill those prisons, and this is a big ball that we're unraveling here. In order to fill those prisons, you have to actually create legislation that makes it easier for people to slide into those prisons, right?
1980, in the early 80s, Brad, we had less than 300,000 people incarcerated. You build it, you fill it. Today, we're talking about 2.5 million. And if we don't turn off the faucet, which is why what we're doing with our young people is so important, because these teenagers now that's creating this violence, they were not born murderers. They were not born predators.
That's right.
Their environment turned them into it. So your 0 to 10 is a huge, huge development process that your environment creates this mindset. There's really four major components that leads to this issue, which we're talking about. Moral decay. All right. Teenage pregnancy, all the things that come into play to those type of things. Educational demise, 52% of black boys drop out of high school throughout the United States of America. Lack of black owned businesses and underserved community, which was not a problem prior to integration, because black people, we had to own economy, which then you could hire people in the community to work. Okay.
Right.
So then you take those social determinants, which are created from 1, 2, and 3. So those are your four deals that lead to this high homicide rate that must be addressed collaboratively, or you can't fix it by just focus on one. So it has to be a strategic initiative with the churches, with the business community, yeah, with the education component, that we can suspend our most vulnerable kids. We suspend our young black boys because, okay, hey, they probably not nourished that well, born into a teenage mother. They have low nutrition, all those type of things. And then they come there, they have, attention disorders. They have several things. Then we suspend them. Well, who are we sending them home to now, Brad? Who's home?
Right. Nobody there. It sounds like what I'm hearing you say, we need all hands on deck.
It's save our sons
all
now.
Hands on deck.
Yes. That's what it is. I mean, Brad, this is a crisis. No other ethnicity is suffering from this epidemic. 30 black boys die a day in America, which is almost 9,000 annually. I call it hood roulette. Hood roulette, because and people not dying up in North Dakota, Montana.
Right.
You know where the death is going to come from gun violence for most part. I'm just saying where this disproportionate death is taking place. Satan is killing, stealing, destroying, just like you said.
Wow. Man, this is such a big topic. And so how do you organize this, Coach? Like, you know, knowing, you know, like, cause knowing makes no difference, right? Like we know that this prison system isn't working. We know that it's designed to trap people and pull people into it. So you got to keep the beds filled. You build it, you got to fill it. Like you said, how do you organize the people that really have the power to make a difference? And the thing about it is, people act on what they see value in, right?
Yeah.
We went to Afghanistan because there was value there. Somebody saw value and said, hey, this is worth us throwing $20 billion there. There's something in Ukraine that's valuable to somebody or somebody's. Yeah. And they said, it's worth throwing $1 billion over there, right? So how can we show the value, man, so that people are willing to invest? Like, how do you get people on board? How do you get people enrolled in that this is so important? It's critical, like really, literally, because with the statistic that you're throwing out there, Coach, what that literally means to me, I'm sitting here thinking as you're sharing that, literally, fast forward us 50 years, dude, we ain't going to be around.
No, there's no question. But
can't reproduce.
But here, and you know, our boat, that's why the Hispanic population, we used to be the second largest minority, but we're not now because of the things that we're discussing. When you start looking at us as a people, you take the nearly 500 deaths that I told you in 1950 and multiply 2 to 3 kids every generation. How many people you got then? But you can't when you're dead. And here's the deal, Brad. We can't wait for the government. The civil rights movement, we wasn't waiting for anybody else. Rosa Parks, Dr. King, all our civil rights icons, it was within our own community. You realize the bus, you know, the Rosa Parks sitting on the bus. Nobody did that but our community. We decided, hey, we're not going to accept this. But it was a civil rights movement. I'm calling this within our own civil responsibility movement. It has to come from within our own grassroots efforts because, listen, down in Mississippi brought all the people who led the sacrifice for us to have equality and have our rights. It's the same thing as within. We can't let these people run our community any kind of way because we're scared. That never would have happened for men in our community when we were growing up. Now, we close the curtain and say, man, I can't say nothing because so-and-so might... They're running the community. So now, why other people gonna value what we don't even value in our community? That's a problem. All right. And so now, when we want other people to value what we value, and listen, resources. You know how much Black America's worth? $1 trillion. If we aggregated our resources together, that makes us in the top 12 richest nations in the world. So our resources are fragmented, which keeps us, from uniting for the cause. Whereas when we were segregated as a people, we moved as a whole rather than moving individually. That's the issue that's putting a strain on us moving together. But the positive thing is, and I'm working on it, it's called First and 45 with Coach Fitzhill, you know, the game plan to tackle the epidemic of Black male homicide in America. I'm putting a game plan book together, and that's what I come back on and shit, because it's just like I did a coaching game plan. It's what I put together. It's okay. This is what we're doing the first quarter. This is what we're doing the second quarter. This is what we're doing the third quarter. Because really, 45, if you get a Black boy to 45, he's out the danger zone. He's going to become a grandparent.
That's right.
Let's go back over here.
Let's celebrate. That's right. Run that again.
All right, so now, look, you go make sure that your little nephew or niece, everybody does that. But what happened? When all these little kids, they don't never get to see that. They don't know, so they think that they're supposed to die early. So they don't. They have no value in life. They going to prison. Well, one guy told me, hey, a rapper, if I go to prison, I get more sales. Now, that's I think about how dysfunctional that is, man. Totally different from thinking. So prison is an affirmation of validation, and that's totally different from what you and I experienced growing up in our communities. You know, people tell us to stay away from down at, you know, Northwest. Hey, y'all be in the dorm on time. Coach Hill coming by there and check curfew. We're not playing. Those are standards of expectations. I tell people, you give people love, food, and godly expectation. And in that order, and then you got a chance to be successful. Don't make it complicated. Yeah. You know, I say, wake up, show up, and follow up. Give it to them in threes, and then they know what they're supposed to do. And encourage them and love them, you know, through the tough times.
Yeah. Man, so much. I mean, covering the whole world. And, when you talk about coming around to the dorm, I mean, you know, it made such a big difference, man, having that, you know, and of course, we sneak out sometimes, you know, and y'all knew we were doing it because y'all did the same thing. Y'all did college and play ball, right? But you knew that we were in the rules at a certain time. And for the most part, we were pretty disciplined about it. So just having it was, like you said earlier, it's like being a coach in college, even in high school, it's kind of like being a second, third dad. like it's that male figure. And even if you're, even if your coach is a female, there's that guy, there's that structure, that guidance is there that gives young men a direction to follow, man. It gives them a path that they can see something forward for themselves. I think that, and I, you know, sometimes I go back and forth. I'm like, okay, you know, not everybody can play in the NFL. Not everybody can play in the NBA or baseball, you know, but I think starting in sports is a huge way to really show guys, hey, man, there's something possible, because a lot of these guys are going down in music and in the rap trap. And man, that, yeah, that there is like a cesspool of death.
Well, I mean, no question. I mean, that's probably, rapping is probably the most dangerous profession for a black man you could ever be involved in. But you said a point that I think my second and third, oftentimes what I found, the coach was oftentimes the father, and you know, I took that with great responsibility when a mother gave me, you know, her son and said, you know, I want you to, you know, to mentor to my child. Hey, I did that. Probably, you know, being the president of Arkansas Baptist College, you know, we were able to do a lot of things to bless a lot of, you know, to bless the community and bless a lot of kids. But the thing that I'll take to my grave with me is that, you know, during my period of time that we touched over, you know, over 10,000, you know, black boys and who probably wouldn't have had the opportunity to go to college otherwise had we not been an open enrollment place for them to come. Some of them had, you know, backgrounds that other schools wouldn't accept them. But, you know, Jesus never suspends or he doesn't put out. So I give the grace. I call it education with grace. As long as you're willing to follow instruction and, you know, and don't bring riffraff with you, I'm going to work with you. But the first time that you show me, you know, that you're going to deceive me, I'm not going to work with you, because what you're doing, you're messing up the opportunity for me to do that for somebody else who really want to take into, you know, it's serious about what we're doing. But I can't tell you the stories of education and restoration that we've taken for violent offenders who come back and said, hey, coach, I never had a person to talk to me like you have, and I'm going to do what you asked me to do. And, you know, and I said, okay, you know, what you do speaks so loud, I can't hear what you say. As long as you do it, we rolling.
That is. Love it, man. I love it. And I think that there's a lot of, I think a lot of guys are actually looking for that kind of guidance. They just don't.
No question. It's,
sometimes they don't even recognize it when they see it. It's like, wait, what, you actually care about me?
Like, yeah. But I'm telling you, if you get into a gang, there's so much structure in gangs. They take discipline in gangs. I mean, you can't go in there popping your lip. You know, they tell you what to do and you do it. All right. But they've shown you some form of love and caring about you by feeding you and taking care of you. So now when they tell you to do something, you're going to do it. The same way over here. I mean, it's like parents. I mean, you know, you don't always like what your parents told you, you know, would tell you to do, but you knew that they cared about you because why? They fed you, you know, they clothed you, they did all those things. And so when people are not getting that at home, and then they go over here and the drug dealer or the gang leader tell them to do that because they start giving them stuff they'd have, then they become loyal to them and they do what they ask them to do. I mean, that's the environment. I'm saying, when you create that environment, then people respond to it.
That's right. And they also know there's a consequence attached to it, right? By me not doing something, or your parents say you do something, you don't do it. There's a consequence.
And normally when there is no discipline, then the discipline takes place in prison.
That's right.
I mean, you can't just do what you want to do, you know, and there'll be no consequences. You know, they say abuse leads to restriction. But I often tell people, rules without relationship equals rebellion. You have to have relationship before you give them rules. Once you do that, you know, I remember as president, Brad, people come over and say, well, why do these boys wear their pants down below the butt? You know, when it first comes to them.
Yeah.
They said that. I said, nah, that don't bother me right now. I said, that's part of the cleaning process. I said, to clean the fish, you got to catch it. And I said, it's an educational process. And I said, I don't worry about how they wear them when they come in. I worry about how they wear them when they leave. I said, because what I realized, when you elevate the mind, the pants come up. See, it's a process. You know what I'm saying? So don't, you know, because now I can tell them, I said, now where you want to work? Oh, you going to work for BET? Okay. Yeah, they may let you do that on the wall, you know, 105 in the park or something like that.
Right.
Because I had a black male leadership class I would teach to all the boys. And so then, you know, and we'd sit around and talk. Then I say, well, you want to work in the tech and IBM? Probably not going to be able to sag in that, you know, right there for that. Or if you're going to be, I said, I can get you a coat and tie. And so here's why you're okay. So this is what's accepted here. So then when they understand, you know, I said, now look, tonight just Friday night or Thursday night, you're going out. If you want to do that and walk in there into the little dance like that with your pants, that's appropriate place to be. I say, yeah. But now, well, you going to come to church with me on Sunday? That's not appropriate. They never been taught that before. So I used to tell them why they sat, because ain't nobody ever told them to pull them up in that context.
That's right.
When you know better, you do better. And I haven't learned that to be true yet.
Yes, absolutely. And when you notice someone's fighting for you, someone's got your back, someone's supporting you, you're more inclined to do what they ask you to do when you know that they're looking out
love
for you.
Love them, feed them, and very seldom are they going to say, what you, no, I ain't going to do that. No, I said, no, I'm loving on you. Got right. Your arm around, tell you, now you get all you want to eat right here now. You got a bed over to sleep in. All right, now this is what I need you to do. All right, Dr. Hill, we got you.
There you go.
That's it.
There you go. And I think that's what, now you're going back to Prime, I think that's what Coach Prime is doing so well. You know, and I know you've been into many living rooms and talking to parents, particularly mothers who are having their boys go off. And it means so much for those women to have their young boys, 17, 18 years old, go to a school, whether they're playing football or doing academics, to have a male figure there that they know their sons are in good hands. I know Prime's pitch is when he comes to that living room, he's like, hey, I ain't going to just have your boy be a great football player. He's going to leave my school being a young man. His pants might be sagging now, no, like you said. But in 4 years, his pants going to be up. Yeah. He's going to either be in the league or he's going to have a great job.
That's exactly
right.
And that, and that's the game plan, you know, that we have to give them for life, just like we do for, you know, for preparing for competition. Yeah.
Coach, man, this has been a great conversation. I'm looking forward to getting that playbook, man.
I'm excited. I got my publishers coming out this spring, and it's very practical for what Black boys need. You know, it's not complicated, and then, you know, because we're fumbling, you know, we're throwing interceptions, we get sacked. You know, our Black boys are dying each and every day, and we have to assume that responsibility to help our young men get to 45 so they can become grandparents. And so things change. The thrill, you mentioned my grandson. I'm getting ready to have my second grandson this spring, and just thrill to say, man, it's given me a reason to try to live to 80 so I can see them, you know. So now I'm working out, I'm eating right, I'm doing all the things that are necessary. But what oftentimes happens when we're investing in young people or investing in our lives to try to do that, and then some come up, Satan come to kill, steal, and destroy and take something from somebody, that pain is so intense. Because, you know, that person didn't have what he needs, but hurting people hurt other people, which then, you know, tames the American dream into a nightmare.
Man, so well said, Coach. Man, you dropped so many jewels, so many dimes here, man. So, Coach, I want to give people an opportunity to follow you. Like, where can they find you? What's some of your social? I know you and I connected on LinkedIn. We're connected on Facebook. So how can people find? Maybe they can find out about the game plan that you're developing. How can they keep up with you?
Yeah, I just want to come out. But, I'm on Twitter, you know, at Fitz Hill. I'm on Instagram, Fitzgerald Hill. I'm on all the social media. Those four, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook. You have no problem finding me on there. And then if they follow you and they want to more information about me to get in touch with me, they can reach out to you. And then you can send them to me, okay?
Awesome, man. I appreciate you, brother. Hey, have a great game great time at the game tonight. Go on, watch Juice play. Good luck to the Tigers. Go Tigers, and be safe driving down to Athens, man.
All right, Matt. God bless. Right, thanks for having me, Brad.
My pleasure, man. See you soon. Bye-bye.
This is Doris Brown's baby boy. We out.